Hey guys, Noah here. I had the opportunity to sit down on the Meet the Podcasters podcast here recently with James Deeney and got to talk about the Code Story podcast, got to talk about our workflow, how we do things on the show, and I'm just really excited to share the episode with you today. We talk about a workflow, we talk about music, we talk about creating a narrative, and so I think you're really going to like this conversation. Check it out and enjoy.
Hi everyone. Welcome to Meet the Podcasters. This is James Deeney. My guest today is Noah Labhart. Noah is the host of Code Story, and he's also the CTO and co-founder of Variable, which is an on-demand labor marketplace for manufacturing and logistics. Noah's podcast, Code Story, is all about exploring the human side of building a tech startup from scratch, told in the words of the founders themselves. As an expert in that field himself, Noah is able to ask the right questions to walk listeners through the process of how each guest went from an idea sketched on the back of a napkin to a fully functioning product with thousands of users. One thing that really stood out to me about Code Story is the fact that it's had a really high production value right from the beginning. The interviews are tightly edited to craft a narrative in each episode. Noah takes time to carefully script out an introduction that sets the scene for listeners, and episodes feature hand-picked backing tracks that help convey the key stages of each guest's journey. Put together, all this creates a fully immersive audio experience, similar to many NPR podcasts in its style. But Noah is able to do all that with only just a tiny fraction of the budget and resources that NPR have to work with, which is really impressive. And in this interview, I spoke with him about his journey with Code Story so far and some of the parallels that exist between starting a company and starting a podcast. We discuss why it took Noah almost a year to publish his first episode, how to keep a high bar on podcast quality by hiring the right people. We talked about Noah's approach to crafting narratives from long-form conversations, finding royalty-free music, and the art of adding music to your podcast. And towards the end of the conversation, Noah talks about the different methods he's used to find sponsors for Code Story, and he also gave his predictions on the tech innovations we're likely to see soon in the podcast industry. As always, you can find links to the resources we mentioned in this episode on the podcast.co website, so be sure to check those out. But now, let's get into the conversation. Today, I'm joined by Noah Labhart. Thanks for coming on the show, Noah.
Thanks for having me. Super glad to be here.
So, as I was listening to some episodes of Code Story in preparation for this podcast, the first thing that came to my mind as I was listening was that these episodes must take a long time to put together. It's easy to hear the work that goes into each one. So I'm excited to have an opportunity to learn a bit more about your processes in this conversation. But I thought we'd start things off first by going back in time a bit. So how did your relationship with podcasting first begin? When did you start listening to them on a regular basis?
Sure. Podcasts, I've been listening to podcasts for several years now. And I think when it really started for me, I had a buddy that started his own podcast. His name's Chris Graby, one of my best friends in the world. And he started a podcast with his wife. It's now called the Live It Well podcast. And it's a spiritual marriage relationship kind of based podcast. And so I kind of got to observe the process there. Also had another friend, Kaylee Porter, who started a podcast about infertility and women. And so I kind of watched them, watched the process, and was like, okay, that's really cool. I listen to podcasts. It's fun to me. I enjoy it. I enjoy having the selection and the ability to choose what I want to listen to. But that was kind of early days when I really started to get the bug for making Code Story. I got introduced to how I built this with Guy Raz. Mm-hmm. And I love the way Guy Raz drives an interview to surface the most interesting points. And I could, you know, when I first got introduced to how I built this, I would binge listen. I would just episode by episode, just love the way the stories were drawn out. And even more, I love the way that the music and the narration and the questions created tension in the story and resolution at certain points in the story, to where it's an audio experience. It's not it's not just a an interview and just a talk, just a talking points, which are also good. I enjoy those as well. But for me, that rich audio experience really just it really came to life for me when I started listening to that podcast. I'm a musician. I've been doing music for a long, long time. I was in a band and we produced several records, and so I understand the studio aspect and things like that. And so there was something really artistic about the audio experience that Guy Raz was creating. So that really was the kickoff point and a lot of the inspiration for how I structured Code Story.
Yeah, you can definitely hear that influence kind of shining through the NPR style type production, which we will get into later, I'm sure. I'm really keen to talk to you about the music aspect of it. But essentially, was your idea to take what you heard in that podcast and then apply it to your own career and think, how can I make this work with the things I'm involved in? What would that look like if I was going to tell or present an audio experience about the tech world? Was that the idea?
Similar. Yeah, it was. It was a big takeaway for that. I mean, you know, when I started out with, you know, Code Story, I was thinking, you know, I'm having a lot of conversations with other CTOs, other startup founders, where, you know, we're talking about the journeys we're walking through, not just like, hey, what tool did you use for this? Or, hey, you know, how did you manage an employee like this? It's really about the journey. Mm-hmm. It's about the, you know, trading war stories. How'd you feel during that time? You know, once you picked that technology and you realized you had to ditch it later, were you pissed off? You know, things like that. Like, what was it? What's the human experience there? And so I was having lots of those conversations. At the same time, having, you know, getting into how I built this, I was looking for that type of podcast in tech with a sort of tech drive behind it. And not necessarily like, you know, ones and zeros, all coding. This is what I did on line 227 type of thing. But more, again, about the human experience from the technology side, the technology visionary. And so those two things sort of were the basis of where I started there. And it, you know, I do take a lot from the conversations that I get to have. It's really fun for me. I get to talk to peers that are doing, you know, similar things in different industries. And it's really fun to talk about the decisions and the walks that we've gone through.
And that's one of the things I was thinking, because you're obviously a CTO and your company Variable has been running for a number of years, and I was wondering, is there a connection between Code Story and your company, or is it an entirely, you know, separate entity that's just purely for the sake of producing the podcast? Is there a connection there?
That's a good question. So there's not a connection between Variable other than me and the fact that I'm the CTO at Variable. It started out just kind of as a fun side project for me. It's its own entity. You know, prior to Variable, I ran a mobile development agency called TouchTap. So I kind of did some creative things through TouchTap. The podcast was one of them, or at least where it started. TouchTap is no longer in operation, but obviously the podcast is. But no, it's not affiliated with Variable. However, it has influenced the way, or I'd say more rounded out the way that I understand podcasts and how useful they are, not only for podcast listeners, but for brands, for businesses, things like that. And so I am a huge champion for Variable to start a thought leadership podcast in the world of operations, manufacturing operations, you know, obviously labor, because that's one of our sweet spots. And that is our sweet spot. We're on-demand marketplace for labor. Mm-hmm. So really starting a thought leadership podcast around the operations world, I think it'd be really not only be valuable for us as a brand, but bring a lot of value to that industry.
In preparing for this conversation, I listened to the conversation that you had over with the guys at Squadcast and on their Between Two Mics podcast. And just touching on this point, in that episode, you drew parallels between starting a podcast and starting a company? Because I think very quickly your operation with Code Story expanded beyond just you as a one-man operation, and you quickly began to take on more people to help you produce and publish these episodes. So I was wondering if you could kind of talk a bit more about those similarities that you see between starting a company and starting a podcast in the way that you have.
Yeah, absolutely. I see a lot of parallels, and my involvement with startups really helped me. I would say build my workflows in a way that was efficient. Not perfect. I still have a ways to go in making this an efficient, well-oiled machine. Mm. But being able to put some things in place as things got more time-consuming was really helpful. So, I started up the podcast, I was talking to my longtime friend, college roommate, Ryland Barnes. He was a tech entrepreneur around here in Dallas, successful tech entrepreneur. And, I told him, I was like, hey, I want to do this podcast, and this is the topic, and this is what I'm going to kind of do, this is what it's going to feel like. What do you think? And he was like, oh, man, that sounds great. I would totally be a listener. I was like, good, you're going to be my first interviewee then. And so on the spot, I made him sign up there. So I interviewed him in October of 2018. And, I took like 6 months working on that first episode, trying to find time, trying to let go of perfection, trying to really build my pilot episode, my MVP, call it, to use a startup term. And, my initial product there, and it was taking me so long, and I wanted so badly to be able to do it myself. I just didn't have time between, I'm married, been married for 11 years. I have 3 children, startup CTO, and then podcast. So there's just not a lot of extra time. So I finally was like, okay, I got to get out of my own way here. I'm the linchpin, or I'm not the linchpin. I'm the blocker here, for Code Story that happened. So, ended up hiring my first editor for season 1, George Macharko, who did a fantastic job, did really good, immediately latched on to the vision of the music and how we're creating a story and, a narrative. And he's not a tech guy. He's a audio engineer, I would call him. And he's also a podcast host himself. But he did a fantastic job and crafting the stories and really latched on. So we worked really well together. So George joined the team, and then Deanna Chapman actually helped with some of the promotions. She joined the team to help with the social media, newsletter, things like that, to try to get the word out about the podcast in the early days. So, built an MVP, formed a small sort of startup team, and then launched the first episode in June of 2019, and started out monthly. I'm sorry, not monthly, every 2 weeks episodes, and got so many interviews in the queue and got some good traction out of the gate where I was like, we got to go every week. It's not going to be worth it, I think, to me, if we're not doing it every week. So we switched over after about, I think, 10 episodes, something like that, to every week. And that was 40 or 50 episodes. I'm not sure what number we're on now. Ago. I have switched editors, switched teams since then. George and I have parted ways, and amicably we support each other. So now my editor is Bradley Denham of Record Edit Podcast. He does a fantastic job as well on his team. So, that's a little bit of the parallels there between, you're starting something up, you're building a product, you're building an early product, you have to form a team, you have to form processes, you have to figure out, okay, what are the long poles in the tent, essentially? What are the critical path items that you got to get out of the way and delegate and not get in your own way like I did, and make it happen?
Yeah, I think that experience that you described of having an idea and then kind of sitting on it for months, maybe years at a time, is something that's common for a lot of people that have an idea for a podcast. And one of the things that struck me as you were describing that process of how you got out of your own way and hired people, was that it's kind of it's a brave move when the podcast doesn't exist yet and you're already expanding the team, hiring extra people and sinking costs into the production of the podcast. So was this something that you were happy to make the investment in, that you were confident that this was going to be something that you would be doing years in the future? What was the thing that encouraged you to kind of make the investment initially to get it off the ground?
That's a great question. I started out with TouchTap sort of still running at the time. So I had some funds there to be able to use, to be able to invest in the podcast. And I looked at it like, okay, this is something that is going to be highly valuable to people. It's going to be a really awesome product, a really awesome creation, and it's going to be evergreen, essentially. You know, the stories might get somewhat stale, you might say, just because they're a little bit time-based, but they're really all around the beginning of these successful companies. So the beginning really doesn't ever get stale. You know, you just add more stories on after it. So I was really excited about that. And so I was really excited to do it the right way and make sure that we were creating a quality product. And so investing, you know, some funds into it, paying a team was a thing that I thought was a worthy cause. Since then, you know, we've started taking on, you know, advertisements in the show. We have mid-roll and pre-roll and things like that. Mm-hmm. And other sort of revenue generating options that really, we're not making money. We're really just covering costs. So I'll be honest there. But it is something where we are taking on sponsorships and things now to be able to cover those costs, because TouchTap's no longer there. I would be essentially fronting it personally. And after a while, it starts to add up.
You can see the rationale behind that decision. And in many ways, I think it's a wise one, because the way that the podcast landscape is these days, if it's not quality, it makes it so much more difficult to build an audience. You want whatever initial point of contact people have with your show, you want the production quality to be high and listeners to be impressed, so that you can, you know, slowly build up the audience over time. And as you said, like, it's not a get rich quick scheme, but eventually, if you keep delivering quality week in, week out, then the listener base will grow and you will start to see a return.
Absolutely, James. You know, there's something you reminded me of when you were saying that. It's similar in the mobile world. So I'm a software developer for a long time, 15 plus years. And most recently, before Variable, a mobile developer and doing iOS development. And the same thing is true in the mobile world. If you don't put out an app that looks good, that feels good from an experience standpoint, you're going to get a lot of negative feedback. So you really have to think about what sort of product you're putting out in front of people, because the reality is the market nowadays is saturated, whether it be mobile apps, whether it be podcasts, whether it be other things. You know, the barrier to entry in creating something nowadays is pretty low, which is great, right? It's awesome because you can jump out and just do it. But it also creates this challenge on the other side, is that anyone can just jump out and do it, and not everybody's going to keep an eye on quality. So you really gotta be able to shine there.
Yeah, that's important. That's what we try and communicate at podcast.co. It really is about the quality. And I just kind of wanted to move on to talk a bit more about the episodes themselves, the narrative format. Maybe we'll get into the music as well. But first of all, obviously all of your guests are very technically minded people. And the cliche in the tech world is that engineers aren't always the best communicators. And given the nature of your show, there always is a chance that you could get lost in the technical details or get bogged down in jargon. But I think you managed to very successfully, you know, avoid that from happening. So is there anything that you consciously do to avoid that? Do you select guests who you know can communicate well in advance, or what's your thinking there?
That's a great question, and you're right on. And I'm one of them. For a long time before I was a podcaster, I'm not a verbal communicator. You know, I'm a programmer by trade, so it takes a lot of practice. And you're right. Stereotypically, we are all not very good communicators. But I don't. For me, I've been really lucky. I don't really have to screen anyone to come on the show. What I target is the founding members of technology teams or the technological visionaries, the technological visionaries for a founding team or as a founder of a SaaS product or something like that. And typically to do that, you have to be able to communicate either what value you're bringing by building your product or communicate to your partner and to your teams what you're trying to execute. So it kind of comes out in the wash based on who I'm targeting there, but it's not a pre-interview making sure someone can have a conversation. I think the second part too is the way that I structure the interviews kind of dips into the technology and then dips out and then dips into the technology and then dips out. And I'm glad that comes through. You mentioned that the episodes don't get caught into the technical jargon too much, and I don't want that. I do want some because it's a tech podcast. I want to talk about the hammers and the nails and the tools that these builders are using, because that the technology is essentially that. It's the hammers, the nails, and things like that. So I want to bring those up and talk about them in an architectural way, but I don't want to get stuck. And I think the way that the questions are structured really keep the interview going into the human side too. You know, we start out talking about, tell me about the MVP. You know, what tools did you use to build it? And, say someone comes in and says, oh, I use this technology and this technology, and it took us 6 months to build. And I'm like, okay, cool. So let's talk about the decisions you had to make in choosing those tools and cutting features. How did that make you feel? How did you cope with those things? How did you deal with the technical debt that you were creating that you were going to have to deal with later? How were you making plans for that? So it is about the technology and what is being built, but it's about the decisions and the journey that person is going through. So I think that also helps kind of keep us out of the ones and zeros.
Yeah, so before you go into the episode, you don't have an idea of the story you want to tell. Do you go in and ask your questions and kind of let your guest guide you and whatever story they happen to reveal, that's the path you'll take? Or do you go into these interviews thinking, well, this person has built this company and this is what I think this story will sound like? Or how do you approach that?
That's a great question. So the way that I typically do it is I send them essentially what I refer to as the spine of the interview. And it's essentially a set of questions that I know that I'm going to center around. Mm-hmm. And I tell the guest that I was like, this is what I'm going to essentially walk you through. And for the most part, I'm going to stick to it. But if you answer something that's interesting, I'm going to start digging into it a little bit. If they talk about, really interesting quality that they look for when they're building their team, I want to dig into that a little bit. Tell me about that a little more. Why is that quality important? Or, if someone chose to start building their solution in a scalable way at the very beginning versus fixing it later when they've got a million users, I want to know why. That takes a lot of foresight. So I may dig into, okay, why did you decide to do that? Because that's a lot of work up front. You obviously saw something that other people didn't by doing that. Tell me more. What were you thinking there? So I'll use the general spine to direct and outline the interview, but I will dig in here and there to the most interesting parts.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of doing it. It makes sense when you outline it. So when you have that initial conversation, how long do those original raw recordings usually last? Because obviously the final product is quite tightly edited into a 20-30 minute window, but what are those original conversations running?
They usually run about an hour or less. I'd say between 45 minutes and an hour. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a warm-up part that I also do at the very beginning, where before I get into the product and before I get into the what the company is and what the product is that they built and how they got started with it, I will ask them about them. I will say, okay, before we jump into this, tell me about you outside of tech. What are your hobbies? What do you do? Do you have any family? Do you like to get outside? What do you do that's analog, not digital? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times hobbies are still tech-based or hobbies are totally different. You know, it just depends on the person. And what I do with that part of the interview, which usually is probably about maybe 5-10 minutes of that 45 to an hour, is I create my own introduction. So I take that information and I create my own introduction to the episode. And I don't put it in the episode at all. So it's a great time for us to warm up, to kind of get used to talking back and forth to each other, to get to know each other a little bit on, you know, not just tech and product related stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I throw it away. I essentially use it to create the intro, record my own intro, and I don't put it in the episode.
Using that technique, is that to kind of make that your guests feel comfortable with you and settled into the conversation so that more interesting stuff will come out in the conversation about their tech and company?
Absolutely. Yeah. I want them to feel like, and I tell them this too, you know, some guests will come with a script essentially like, okay, you sent me the questions. I've got an answer for each one. And I put a paragraph down and yeah. I say, whoa, I mean, that's great. I'm glad you have some talking points and thank you for taking this interview seriously. You know, I appreciate that in all humility, but I also want you to feel like we're sitting in a coffee shop and we're, you know, two peers and you're telling me about your startup and all the fun stuff you went through, all the good, the bad, and the ugly that you went through to make this thing happen. Mm. And, you know, don't feel like you have to recite something to me. We're going to edit it. We're going to put music to it. Yeah. We're going to craft the narrative. But so just talk to me like we're in a coffee shop. You know, you can hear the baristas, frothing the milk behind us, you know, making the espresso. Mm. We're having a coffee and talking over the journeys we've gone through as tech founders. And so that first part helps to create that feel of, you know, just tell me who you are. Tell me your story, you know, tell me who I'm talking to. And so that does help a lot.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's not something that I've heard loads of other people doing, but I think the way you've explained it, it does make perfect sense in that to get to the really the juicy material or the in-depth material, people do need to feel like they're comfortable and they know you. You did mention your current editor, Bradley Denham, and I wanted to talk a bit about what that relationship looks like. How does that work? Because obviously, you know, if the conversation is being edited down from a longer initial recording, is Bradley making those decisions or are you laying out what you want Bradley to do and then he's, you know, mixing and editing the final episode for you?
Sure. So Bradley will mix and do the final episode, especially now. We've worked together for all of season 2 and we'll be working, you know, moving forward for season 3 as well. So he and his team, he has a team that he works with, does all of the sort of editing, mixing, and musical creations, musical selections based on the feel of the interview. So we've gone through some repetition of, okay, Bradley, let's get real close on this episode. And let's talk through every minute, and I'll tell you what I'm thinking and where I think there are too many ums, you know, and mm-hmm. where I think the part of the story is that is interesting and is tense and, you know, or part of the story that's sad or part of the story that's like, yeah, you know, you really need to throw some awesome music there, you know?
Yeah.
And so early on, you know, we would have conversations about that, a little more detailed conversations and when we were in, you know, post-production and doing the editing and things. And after a while, Bradley just got it. And really, Bradley got it in the beginning. But after a while, we got in sync about what we want mm-hmm. or what I want the show to be. And so nowadays, he'll see me an episode and I might have a small tweak here and there. But really, it's just, okay, that sounds great. I'm gonna put it up for for release next week. Great job.
Nice.
So yeah, it took, you know, it took a little bit of close conversation early on with George and with Bradley, but not much. They both latched on to the idea really, really well. And that's, I mean, they're both amazing editors too.
Yeah. I mean, that's the ideal scenario when you can just put your trust in someone else that they understand the vision and they can make the right calls. I mean, that's a great position to be in. I was hearing that Bradley does the music side of things. I did want to ask you a bit about that in terms of, like, you know, is it Bradley doing all the musical choices, or have you got any say? And I was also wondering where you source the music. Obviously in podcasting, royalty free music is a big thing that people are looking out for, and I was just wondering, you know, where does the music come from and how do you decide what makes the cut in the edits?
Sure. Yeah, good question. So Bradley lays out the initial beta episode, and then given, you know, we've gone through this a few times and done some reps where I've changed music here and there. Mm-hmm. He kind of knows again what I'm looking for and where the parts of the interview that are tense versus not. And so he'll basically lay out the beta music. And if there's something where I'm like, I don't know if that really fits what I see happening in the story, let's try something else. Then we'll do that and we'll do a little iteration there. Mm-hmm. So it's typically him and his team that lay it out. For if we roll back to the very beginning, it was George and I doing it very intimately for probably the first 10 episodes of just like, that doesn't work. We need something that sounds like this, or, you know, something that, you know, is a little more subtle, or there's too much drums here, there's too much treble in that, and it's kind of mixing with the voice. So mm-hmm. we had to do some iteration there to figure out some of that. As far as where we sourced it, one of the primary sources is musicbed.com. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, for $10 a month, you can get a, you know, YouTube podcaster account and you can source music from there. There's a handful of other places that are not coming to mind right now. I'll have to get that list out. But there's a handful of other places where there's some royalty free music. MusicBed has the, for my taste and for what I've seen, MusicBed has the best quality. It is a paid platform for that $10 a month, but mm-hmm. it has really good quality. Studio musicians, I really like very simple, ambient, maybe electronic music as well in the background to help the stories, and they have a lot of that. So I tend to go there first.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. These paid for services do just generally tend to be a lot better. I mean, when you look around online, there is lots of places where you can find completely free, royalty free music. But in terms of the options that you have available, and realistically, you might have to settle for something that's not exactly what you were looking for. So if it is something that you're going to be using day in, day out, like we mentioned before, it's well worth investing a bit of money to help create a quality product.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and even, I don't think Bradley has had to do this yet, and I'm not sure if, it's something that he does, but George actually scored some music, for some mm-hmm. of the things in the podcast too. He, you know, he couldn't find what he was looking for, so he scored a few notes, you know, and looped it for several of the episodes. And, that takes a lot of talent to be able to do that and know what you're kind of wanting to feel there. So that was another thing too.
Nice. I also wanted to talk to you about the fact that you produce your podcast in seasons. So we've talked to other podcasters on this show about producing a podcast in seasons, but why did you decide to do that with Code Story?
That's a great question. And one that I'm still trying to figure out how to answer. I think initially I just wanted to group them together with a beginning and an end. So it felt like it was a package, you know, like, oh, this is season one of Code Story, mm-hmm. you know, and this is, oh, that's in season two. That's a bonus episode in season two. So I kind of felt like that felt more impactful than just releasing episodes on a weekly basis and, you know, keeping the count up to, I don't know, 457 someday, you know, mm-hmm. whereas, you know, season 10, episode two sounds cool to me. There's also kind of a built-in part of it too. I think there's a built-in way to take breaks if needed, mm-hmm. with seasons as well. Cause you know, I, as you can hear in the background, I have a family and I'm a CTO and co-founder of a startup. So it's a busy life, and sometimes I have had no issues having a queue of interviews. In fact, I'm booked into fall right now as far as episodes.
Whoa.
And so that's great. So I have no issues there, but there's also, I kind of want to be able to take a break if I need to, mm-hmm. even just, you know, turn the podcast off for a week or two and say, hey, listeners, I'm going to come back in a couple of weeks, going to take a break. Whether I need to content wise or not, but it also creates a little bit of tension for the users and suspense and, hey, I miss Code Story, you mm-hmm. know, absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Yeah.
I kind of want the optionality of that, and seasons help me do that.
Yeah, it's nice. I suppose I've heard that from a few other people that producing a podcast seasonally really is beneficial for your own sanity, first and foremost, because it does, it can seem a bit relentless if you have to release a new episode every single week forever, which is what some people do. But if you know that you can't take a break, it does give you some flexibility, and also it opens the door to, you know, maybe getting some feedback from listeners on your series and how people reacted to the first series. Is that something that you do, like try and get feedback from your listeners?
I do. Yeah, I do try to, you know, ask, you know, what do you like about the show? What don't you like? What gets in the way? Are there any guests where you're like, man, I'd really love to hear their story?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, keeping a close network of CTOs, I'm able to ask them primarily. I do ask my audience as well, just, you know, whenever it makes sense through newsletters and things like that. I think the biggest feedback, which is one of the biggest things we changed in season two, was the level of the music as far as volume. And I got pretty regular feedback that the volume and type of music was a little distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing, which I have not figured out how to fix, and I don't think I can, is that you can't play it on, you know, 1.5, 2 times, you know, speed. Some people like to listen to the fast speed. Mm-hmm. Which, more power to them. I cannot do that.
No, me neither.
but with the music and stuff, and when it, you know, it's kind of crafted in a certain way, you can't really do that. So I have gotten that feedback too. But primarily, it's been the music. So that's been a big shift in season two. And since we made that shift, we haven't had any of that feedback.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely good to take it on board anywhere you can. And I do understand, like, it is important to get the levels right, and you do want the person's voice and the message that they're presenting to be front and center. So yeah, finding a way to provide a nice backdrop but still keeping the focus on them is always ideal.
Absolutely.
So in terms of growing your audience and expanding, are there any particularly effective strategies you found for, you know, getting more listeners for Code Story?
That's a great question. If I had that formula cracked, I definitely would share it.
it's a hard one to still, crack. It's a hard one to crack.
It sure is. You know, it's interesting. It's another parallel to startups, I'll say, is that, you know, in startups, one thing I've found is that in the early days, you got to work for every download. You got to work for every user. There's a lot of touch. It's a high touch process early on. And it's that way with podcasts too. I've discovered, you know, I think there's a tipping point, like anything, where, you know, you hit the certain inflection point and people start pouring in. You know, I think that mechanism is different for everyone. But early on, it's been, you know, really just working hard to stay connected and network where I can, tell people about the show, ask them for feedback, ask them to share, ask them to do reviews. And every little step like that creates another sort of bubble of exposure. And that's what has been the most useful. I think secondarily useful, or however you say that, I do have a pretty solid network of software developers, you know, CTOs, technology people. And so being able to share that on my personal network has helped kind of jumpstart the podcast. But as far as expanding past that, it has been a lot of high touch, which is really fun in certain aspects because it's a lot of, you know, it's a lot more conversations, which is great. Mm-hmm. But I haven't found any levers that are, you know, if I pull this lever, then people just come flooding in to listen.
Yeah.
Working on that. hasn't happened yet. If you have any secrets, let me know, James.
I wish I did. I don't know, even among the social media channels, like at podcast.co, we always find just Instagram tends to perform best for us as opposed to other channels. And, you know, different businesses and different podcasts will perform differently on different channels. In terms of the social media world, is there anything... Are there any options that you find that tend to work better than others?
That's a great question too. You know, for me personally, I have found a lot of value in LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd say secondarily, probably Twitter and Instagram are useful, but really LinkedIn has been the best one for me, and I haven't really poured into the others as much. I've kind of focused on, you know, where I reside, mm-hmm. which is essentially just LinkedIn.
Yeah.
And everything else is just sort of through automated posting. So yeah, I'd say that's been the most useful one for me. It's there's some startup groups that are there. I'd say another interesting one actually that has been good, a couple actually, is one is Indie Hackers, indiehackers.com, which is a independent builders forum built by Cortland Allen. Actually, was my first episode in season two. He built this, you know, network of people who are building, you know, SaaS solutions and trying to make money off of them. And that's been really, really cool because these stories are essentially about those people, you know. And I've actually gotten quite a few guests from Indie Hackers, even besides Cortland. So that's been an interesting medium. Another one has been a site called Dev2, which is sort of like Indie Hackers for developers, specifically a little more technology based. But that's been another interesting place that I found a little bit of traction from, just because it's software developers, it's you know, founders, it's startup minded people. So that's been good.
Yeah. Is Indie Hackers, is it similar to Product Hunt, or is it different in what it does?
Sort of, you know, so Product Hunt, you know, you upvote the product, right? You post updates on the products and you can comment and things like that. Mm-hmm. Indie Hackers is more of, a community. I would say, and Product Hunt is a community of sorts, yeah, but it's really eye towards the products, right?
Yeah.
Indie Hackers is more like eye towards the process of building your own SaaS, you know, bootstrapping something from nothing and making it successful and how you did that. And there's a lot of community, there's a lot of sharing, there's a lot of, hey, how did you do this? Or, hey, I'm looking for this. Or, hey, what do you think of this? So it's a real communal forum for founders and tech founders specifically. Whereas Product Hunt is a little more wrapped around the products.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Thanks for clarifying that. I think
absolutely
those ways of finding communities that you can, that are a good fit for your podcast, and really in order to make that promotion strategy work, like you said, you really need to be embedded in that community and asking questions and interacting with other members. Because we've seen in the past, some people, you know, they'll go into a Reddit community or a subreddit and they'll try and promote their podcast and get listeners, and you just get banned straight away in that. But it's not a quick win. You can't just run into all these communities and say, oh, go check out my podcast. You need to be kind of actively involved in them to begin with, and then maybe you can say, oh, I've done this, like, what's your feedback, what do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's totally accurate. You know, there's no free lunch, right? Or whatever the saying is, there's there's no quick way to make your product blow up or make you, you know, to do a single post and all of a sudden your stuff goes viral. Mm-hmm. You really got to work for it. And it takes a lot of work to be embedded in a community like that. And, you know, cool thing is if you're podcasting or you're creating a product that is in that realm, it's pretty natural. It's a pretty natural fit to just jump in and be a part, right? Mm-hmm. You can offer value. You can offer advice. You can ask for advice. You know what the jargon is, you know what the lingo is. And so it's easier to do that. Whereas, you know, if I was podcasting about, you know, basket weaving or cross stitching or something, I wouldn't know those first thing, you know, to go and jump in those communities. So I think that helps.
Yeah, definitely. And you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, you're covering your costs. You've secured sponsors for your show. You've got quite a few different sponsors, from the looks of it. So what's your approach there and how do you go about pitching to your various sponsors?
Yeah, so you know, it's still an evolving process right now. I would say, you know, the length of sponsorship we have right now that we're able to secure is about a month, mm-hmm. A month long from a specific sponsor. Right now I use Podcorn heavily, so podcorn.com. Pretty new service as far as podcasters finding advertisers, but it's been pretty valuable for Code Story. Mm-hmm. We have used it, I won't say exclusively, but for a large part of our advertising. There's been a couple of people that have reached out from different advertising agencies. Was it Veritone One, I think is what it's called. They reached out about some other advertising as well. So I'm looking to partner with them. You know, so it's still an evolving formula. It takes a lot of work and a lot of back and forth pitching mm-hmm. and things like that. As part of the pitch, you know, I try to look for advertisers that fit the show type, that fit the audience type, mm-hmm. You know, builders, entrepreneurs, startup people, software developers, people that are open to buying stuff online. You know, they're pretty comfortable with using technology, younger crowd, things like that. So I try to match those demographics with what people are advertising. And then it's a pretty easy sell just to say that, we've got this many downloads per episode, you know, here's our overall downloads, here's our demographics. This is what we'll charge and we're open to talk about it if you think it's too much. So, we'll see, we can go from there.
Nice. So these companies that you're approaching, generally they're companies that might not have done much podcast advertising in the past and you're kind of approaching them with this opportunity, or are you specifically narrowing your options down to people that you've seen engage with other podcasts?
That's a great question. It's kind of a few different ways. The first way is these are advertisers that are these are brands that are represented by advertising agencies through Podcorn or through something else that are looking for spots on popular shows, essentially. Mm-hmm. So that's one. The other is through, the second is through my network of individuals. So I have a close relationship with Dev Mountain, which is a bootcamp for developers. I've actually hired 9 or 10 developers from their nice. Program. For Variable. And so we have a close relationship. I'm on their local team that reviews their curriculum every year. And we stay close. Anyway, the point was they sponsored the first half, I think, of season one or almost all of season one, just because we had that good relationship and they were looking to put, you know, their brand in front of people. The same thing with some of the vendors that I use at Variable. One of them was Dwolla. So Dwolla, I actually worked with. They introduced me to some of their clients. They sponsored the episodes where we interviewed their clients, and then they put the podcast. They created a podcast page about Code Story on their product page. So that was, you know, that's really helpful for traction and things like that. So that's the second category is kind of just relationship based. Like, hey, you know, I'm doing this thing. I think it's interesting. This is what it costs. What do you think? And then, you know, the third one is something that's a little more experimental that you're talking about, just kind of reaching out to individuals, seeing a fit of the demographic and being like, hey, I like your service. I like what you're doing. I think that my listeners would like it. This is what we sort of do on a sponsorship basis. We can even just try for a little while and see what you think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you get some traction, we can commit to a longer term thing. So that one's pretty new, I would say, as far as the approach. But that also takes a little more strategic thought and time to identify those targets. And I haven't quite got a good process around that yet.
I'm aware of some other podcasts that do that particularly well in terms of finding an alignment between what they talk about on their show and the products or services that they're advertising. And it, obviously, you know, the conversion that the advertiser gets just has to be much better as a result of that. You know, the running joke in podcasting is it's like ZipRecruiter or Casper mattresses or whatever, like all these things that, you know.
Simply Safe.
Exactly. who is actually, you know, buying all these products. But yeah, if you can get the alignment right, then you don't need a massive audience in order for it to be, you know, worthwhile for the advertiser to actually get conversions off the back of it. I'm mindful of your time, so I just have a few questions left. Because you have a knowledge of tech and you understand what's going on in that space, I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on the direction that podcasting is heading in terms of Apple Podcasts and Spotify are fighting for market share. And obviously the big issue in podcasting at the minute is the discovery problem. It's just not that easy to discover podcasts due to RSS feeds and the way that the whole thing's set up. You can't have a YouTube-like algorithm where episodes are being recommended. You listen to this podcast, so you might like this. That doesn't exist yet. But from your perspective, in a technical capacity, is there anything that you think will be done in that space, or is there any innovation that you think could happen there that will change the landscape in podcasting?
Yeah, I think that there is. I think that, you know, podcasting has been pretty niche for a long time, and now it's becoming really popular, mm-hmm. which causes more people to want to jump in and innovate, right? So when I see you know, more podcasts out there, you know, more people jumping in and doing it, you know, people signing up and using Anchor, right, and just creating a personal podcast, things like that. It creates a much broader market, which is more attractive to building, you know, these newer tools. So someone taking the time to really apply some machine learning and really apply some strategic software architecture around, you know, how do we get the most out of RSS feeds, right? Or how do we get the most out of people's activity? You know, people are really starting to try this now. You know, they've got essentially, you know, social networks built around podcasting, like so Breaker, for instance. You know, Leah Culver over there at Breaker has done a great job building that product. But it's essentially, you know, it surfaces people's likes and activities and listens to where people can respond to that. Now take that data and apply some strategic, you know, model learning on top of it, then you might have something for discovery. You might have something where someone signs up and you're able to say, hey, you know, you're a 38-year-old male in Texas, and, you know, what are some of your interests? Okay, this, this, and this. Okay, you probably want these six podcasts, you know, here we're going to recommend these after, you know, you listen to a certain set of podcasts. Yeah. You know, I think the data is starting to get there, and that's going to be a crucial part for podcast discovery. As far as podcast production, I actually see a lot of interesting things happening. There's a lot of tools that are popping up. A lot of people are trying to solve problems around recording and production and how to string all those things together in a smart way. It's moving slower than my taste. and if I had time, I would love to jump in and help. But, I think that there's a lot of people trying to solve some of these problems, and string together the right workflow without building some sort of, you know, monolithic platform that you have to use, but creating the sort of integrated, connected, horizontal, separate solutions to where everything kind of talks to each other really nice. So I don't know. It's kind of a bounced around answer around production and discovery. I do think that we will see some good solutions come out. It probably just need a little more time.
Yeah, it just seems like there is so much potential there. And with the market just exploding in the way it has over the past 2 years, yeah, I suppose it is just a matter of time. It will be interesting to see, you know, what surfaces over the next few years.
Absolutely. I think it'll be fun to watch.
Yeah, definitely. So lastly, Noah, if you could go back to the start, when you had the initial idea for Code Story, is there anything that you do differently, armed with the knowledge that you have now?
Sure. I think that I'm really happy with how things have turned out. So I believe that, you know, we walk through mistakes and hurdles and milestones and, you know, painful moments for a reason, and they make us who we are. Mm-hmm. So I'm grateful for the journey. If I could go back, I would have hired an editor sooner. Mm-hmm. I think I'd be, you know, 60, 70 episodes in now instead of, you know, 40, 50. So, you know, I think that would have been something smarter to do. And that was a lesson I had to learn for myself. And, you know, at the same time, I'm learning that lesson for my businesses as well at that same time, you know, how to delegate better, how to let go of, you know, engineering control, and how to build a team that can run autonomously. And that was that affected podcasting, that affected my startup world. You know, that was a lesson I was learning at that time. So a little bit of it was timing too. But if I could go back, I would do that sooner, so that I could get out of my own way.
Mm. Well, you're here now. You've got out of your own way. Things are looking good.
I appreciate that.
So where can people go to connect with you, Noah? Obviously LinkedIn probably.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm on LinkedIn. You can grab my profile, there. Check out the podcast at codestory.co or on any podcast directory. You can also learn more about me at noahlabhart.com as well.
Nice. Well, thank you very much. And I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Thanks, James. This was fun. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with the other podcasters or aspiring podcasters in your life, or alternatively, leave it a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your shows to keep the algorithms happy. That's it from me, and I'll see you next time.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now. Save big money
at Menards. If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.